But I've told many it was the best trip I've ever taken. Many times these are things, trips to dread, because there's so many major things that hit along the way. But there are a number of reasons why this is, I think, one of the most enjoyable that I have ever taken. And one of them is that, as I reflected repeatedly, that you were back here praying for us. I think about this once in a while. I figured it up one day. We were sitting in planes off the ground, that is, in the air, for 56 hours since we left. That's the equivalent of 7-8-hour days. Sitting, that's to say nothing about sitting on the end of runways or going to and from airports. And didn't have any close ones of any kind, but had some wonderful times of fellowship and prayer. And during some of those times, we had time to reflect. We thought about the gang back here and how you're praying for us. Appreciate it very much. And this song, Channels Only, became, I don't know where have I ever been before. I don't remember ever hearing it before. I probably did in one way, but it never registered with me like it did when they were singing it out in Singapore. Channels Only, Blessed Master. And Master. Talking about Singapore, you know, after we left Japan, we spoke English without, didn't need an interpreter anywhere else in the trip. That's what I was thinking anyway. But when I got to Singapore, Singapore English is something all of its own. Jimmy Chu met me in Kuala Lumpur. I've told people I was going in Kuala Lumpur, and they said, "Where's that?" Well, that happens to be the capital of Malaysia. And I met Jimmy Chu up there, and we met some friends of his, and they were talking along, and I honestly thought they were talking a foreign language, that they were speaking Singapore English. It's very clipped and rapid. Then they have yet another kind down in Australia. And you know, Leroy, it's the saddest part of my whole trip. Not only did I see no kangaroo down there, I'd expected to fight my way through kangaroo in anybody's home. I expect to be brushing off koala bear and hearing kookaburras and dodging boomerangs. And then I asked every place I went if they knew tiny kangaroo down sport. And you know that they didn't know it? And when I told them I thought it was the Australian national anthem, they thought it was... they didn't take too kindly to that. But then it helped a little bit when I sang one of them for him. You know, what's this part about? Tan me hide when I'm dead, Fred. Tan me hide when I'm dead. Tan me hide when I'm dead, Fred. Tan me hide when I'm dead. So we tan his hide when he died, Clyde. And that's it hanging on the shed. They'd howl. They thought that was funny. And especially when I got to New Zealand and put on the little act. So they tan his hide when he died, Clyde. And that's just the way they talk in Australia. But I began to at least teach them. In fact, at one home that I stayed, the lady of the house, I came in one day, and here she was out in the kitchen humming Timey Kangaroo. So I had quite a ministry along the way. Of course, the little kids down there, they want to know if we have Indians back in Colorado. Oh, sure. Sure, we usually have a little skirmish with the Indians before breakfast just to keep up an appetite. I said, we have about as many Indians in our backyard as you do kangaroo. Proverbs 13:6, you don't need to turn to it, but 5 and 6 have continually gone through my mind as I've reflected on those 7.5 weeks. Verse 6, I will sing to the Lord because he hath dealt bountifully with me. And he hath dealt bountifully with me. Very, very bountifully. Before leaving, we spent quite a bit of time setting forth our objectives and all of our navigator business objectives, and the entire trip, as I have rehearsed them since, were accomplished along the way. Among them were... My number one objective was to spend extended time and to invest in the lives of 3 men, Bob Boardman, Roy Robertson, and Joe Simmons. Had 2 weeks with Bob Boardman, three and a half weeks with Roy Robertson, and 2 weeks with Joe Simmons. Another was to evaluate our progress and see how we're getting along towards our objective. And as I sent word home, I must have had rose-colored glasses on, because everywhere I went, I found us farther along than I had expected us to be in that particular place. And then also many hours were spent helping to set future objectives. Some of you who are at staff conference remember I had worked out a little program there of objectives, activities, and timetable, sort of a planning report that we wanted from our people. So I helped to work these out, and the purpose of which is to get the headlights on in front of our car instead of on the rear. It's all right for me to know what happened last year, but it's too late to do anything about it, and I'm more interested really in what they hope will happen this coming year. And so I have in my notebook the objectives and the activities and the timetable for every country, from Japan on south around through New Zealand, as to what their objectives are for the next year and why, and in what activities they'll engage and when they're going to do them. My personal goals were not all accomplished. One of them was to keep my weight down, and that was a rough job. One day I remember, especially in Australia, ooh, do they feed you there? I had to skip breakfast and lunch the next day after the one evening feed. When a wife works all afternoon and you know it, you just can't say, well, I'm on a diet. And besides, it was good. But I held it down. In fact, I lost a couple of pounds. The hardest part was the exercise. I had some real, but I kept track of it. In the month of October, I was able to get my exercise in 17 out of the 31 days, or 30 days, whatever October has. And so this helped a great deal, but it was really a fight. Another interesting thing, you know, just along the way here, the hairstyles. Here I am at home and I find my daughter constantly brushing hair out of her eyes. You know, why don't they have different hairstyles? It doesn't get in your eyes all the time. So I was over in Japan and I'd go out on the college campus or see some of the girls, and what are they doing sitting there brushing the hair out of their eyes? Same kind of a hairdo. Well, the dresses, you know, I was really amazed in Sydney. I was telling somebody yesterday, they wear a shift kind of a dress. It's about 3 inches above the knees. And you talk about the styles, they're way out ahead. Besides, I won't make any further comment on that particular point. But take the music, for instance. You flip on a TV set over in Japan, and what do you see? Sort of a Japanese version of the Shindig or Hullabaloo or one of those wild forbidden programs in our household. And I was out at Waseda University, one of the English-speaking classes, and Daryl Thompson turned it over to me. So I asked some questions such as, what do you do when you want to have fun, when you want to relax, what do you do? And it was interesting. Well, one said that she liked music, and she liked folk singing particularly. And I found they like to sit around with somebody with a guitar and do some folk singing. And I asked her, well, what do you think of the Beatles? Oh, she said, I like the Beatles very much. So you find it's pretty much the same everywhere you go. I'm not going to report this morning on the servicemen's work. This is Jim Downing's responsibility. We left him in Singapore. He and John were having a great time. And I found it was a very valuable thing for us to leapfrog around the Orient, because I was unable to visit all the places myself. Some I had to skip entirely. So it was a very valuable thing. But I do want to mention the time I had with Lieutenant Dan Green. Some of you remember Dan Green. Dan Green was on a special assignment up in Tokyo when we were there. He had been leading a platoon out in the bush in Vietnam, setting ambushes night after night. This was his job, to lead 46 men. And it was very, very interesting to hear a first-hand report of somebody who's actually sitting out in the water up to your armpits at night, waiting for the VC to come by. And to find the high morale that he reports that our fellows have out there. And he said, let them get into an engagement once and have a casualty or two. He said, the morale goes way up. And just incidentally, on the way through, coming through Hawaii, I was told that some general out there had made a plea for 1,000 for 200 volunteers. I'm not just exactly certain of whether it's my figures here, but the proportion, I think, would be right, of volunteers, 200, to ride shotgun and helicopters. He said, all I can promise is that half of you will be casualties at least. And he had 1,000 volunteers. I talked with one young Marine by the name of Zeke, Zelke's name, we call him Zeke. He'd just been discharged that day out in Okinawa, and he's going to live with Harv Hoslin. That thing is going to get twisted before I get through here by noon time today. That's for sure. So I said, do you think that the Marines can handle the VC? He said, I know they can. Boy, I almost bit my ears off. I said, well, tell me about it. He said, listen, the kind of training that they put us through here on the islands out south of Okinawa, we go through everything that we went through in Vietnam except for real. The pits dug, the stakes, and all the rest. And he said, going out there was just like going out on an exercise. So we really get trained. And Dan Green was telling me what poor shots that the Viet Cong are. And you see, this whole war, it's a funny war. Part of it is laying ambushes and counter-ambushes and so on. Our Marines are trained, when they do get caught in an ambush, instead of flopping down to try to stay out of the line of fire, which will result in mortars being zeroed in on them and all of them casualties, the first thing they do is charge the source of the fire. And yelling at the top of their voice, they're running in there and guns blazing. That's the way they go at it. And they said, what'll happen? The Viet Cong, it'll scare the tar out of them. It's a little different with the North Vietnamese regiments that are down there now. This is getting to be a little different kind of a war. But that's the way they handle an ambush. Well, Vern Bates tells us that for the last 3 months, that things have changed tremendously in Vietnam. He said that the morale is just completely different. He said that even just before he left to come down to meet us in Singapore, he found out that roads were open out of Singapore that had not been open for 3 or 4 years.
Out of Saigon.
You have to. I'm a little confused here. Not having my glasses, I can't think straight. Out of Saigon. Thank you. That's why we need a team operation. You know that? I always knew we'd be good for something. So, he said that also that the Viet Cong are surrendering in greater numbers than they were before. And the thing that they talk about most is the high-altitude B-52 bombings. And that's the thing that we read about so much that people say, oh, what are you using a cannon for to swat a fly? But this is the thing that keeps them awake nights, and they said the thing that bothers them about it is that they can't hear them, and the first thing they know is when the bombs hit, and this just constantly keeps them on the jump. But just some little first-hand reports from things out in Vietnam. I think that the greatest shock to my system were two along the way. One was the tremendous pacifism that there is on the part of so many Japanese. When we got with these English conversation groups, the very first thing everywhere you went was, why don't the Americans get out of Vietnam? Why, if they just get out of there, everything would be fine. But as it is, they're going to embroil us in a war out here. I mean pacifist. And of course, they never had things so good economically. And of course, for me, it kind of upsets me a little bit to think that we're holding them off down there and keeping their shipping lanes open for them while they're prospering economically. And at the same time, they're criticizing us for being out there. When the Straits of Malacca, about 90% of the shipping goes through there. That's just south of Singapore. And that is, of course, one of the goals or objectives. The other thing is, well, I probably shouldn't get off too much on the Vietnam thing, but I did find that I should have gone better prepared on knowing the history and the background of why we're in Vietnam and what's going on. I remember with some college students, we were talking about this, and they started out with during the Pope's visit, and they wanted to know I thought the Pope's visit to America would have on world peace. And I told them I thought it would have none whatsoever. And I said, to me, it's just pure talk, and that's all, and nothing will happen. Well, then they started another attack on me. The point was, if we applied Christian principles to our international relations, then we would get out of Vietnam. So at one point I said, now suppose there was a robber in your neighborhood and he was pillaging your houses and robbing house after house. Now what you're saying is that the best way for us to do is to get the police out of the neighborhood and then the robber will go away. Boy, they began to spit and sputter. They got the application, of course. Why do we get out of Vietnam and let the communists take over? So the Lord gave me a little wisdom there to help get them off the hook. Because that's one of the things you kind of do. But the point was made anyway. But our purpose is not to argue Vietnam and had to do with the gospel. But the interesting thing is that this is what you're faced with. You go down to Formosa and it's entirely different. There they just wish that the 7th Fleet would turn them loose and let them get at them. that's probably the most anti-communist nation in the world, I imagine, would be the Formosa. And to hear David Liao talk about it is quite an experience in itself. Well, enough on that. I'm not going to give you a travelogue, but I thought I would just make a couple major points by way of review on the trip. And number one is that wherever I went, our people are really working at it. By it, I mean that they are seeking to do what it says of Paul in Acts 14:21, and when they had preached the gospel to that city and made many disciples. These guys are pounding the pavement. They are working at it day after day to preach the gospel and to make disciples. I think that, Darrell, when you get back to Japan, and you can even tell them I said this publicly, they've got a little bit, the Bible says not to think more highly of yourself than you ought to, but I don't think you ought to think more lowly either. And I was riding out with Darrell. You don't have to change names, Darrell Thompson, or Thompson and Mason here. But anyway, Thompson, and he was sort of saying that, well, we don't have many exciting things going on out here. And I even know that the fellows out there read the Dear Gang and cried. But when I got down with Darrell Thompson and sat there in one of these English conversation classes in Waseda University, 37,000 students, 15,000 of them are signed up for English conversation classes. They all want to learn English because that's the trade language. And they will talk the Bible, the gospel, Christianity, anything to get into a conversational group. And some of the keenest young Christian Japanese that I met had come to know the Lord 2, 3, 5, 7 years ago through these English conversation groups. This young, sharp young fellow, Philip Tsuchiya, who some of us have known for 10 or 12 years now, he came to know the Lord through this means. Well, here's Darrell, has 6 of these a week, Darrell Thompson. And that puts him in touch on a weekly basis, talking about spiritual things to some 70 or 80 non-Christian Japanese. I said, man, I don't care where you are, anywhere in the world, to have weekly contact with that many non-Christians, that's something. That is something. Now, what we've got to do is to help focus prayer on this thing, that God will get through with this sowing and there'll be some reaping. Bob Boardman has weekly contact in the gospel concerning Christian things with 140 non-Christian Japanese every week. Well, now, I don't know where you would go in this, anywhere that is more exciting as far as evangelistic opportunity as that's concerned. I mean, that's a thrilling thing anywhere in the world. But these guys are at it. Then you talk about businessmen. You know, help me to think of Tokyo not as a city, but as a country. It's fantastic how long it takes you to get something done in Tokyo. Most any city anywhere else except possibly London or a couple of large cities, maybe New York City, you can plan on seeing, you know, make 4 or 5 contacts a day. There you make maybe 1 in the morning, 1 in the afternoon, and that's it. The rest of the time is traveling. I found long ago in travel it's best to be your own travel agent. And again on this trip, I found at least 4 or 5 times where they had us fouled up on, for instance, one hotel we were signed up for had been torn down. When we got to the town, we found out it wasn't. It was down. We had a reservation in it. On plane flights that didn't exist. Yeah. And I also found that they'd put you on some little puddle jumper that'd take you 2.5 hours flying when you could leave later on a jet and get there earlier. So I would be my own travel agent. So I went to go down to to get some of this taken care of. In Tokyo, I went to a travel agent, the only time, and I got burnt once more. Took 1 hour and 40 minutes to get down there, only to find that they couldn't help me. Then it takes you about 45 minutes to recover to get to some other part of Tokyo to get where somebody can help you. And you've shot the afternoon. So it helps me to think of Tokyo not as a city, but as a country, so that when you plan to go to a certain part of Tokyo for a minister, you plan that as an excursion or a trip. In fact, I suggested to the guys, why don't you rent a room downtown? And then plan to stay to take 2 days, go one morning, stay overnight, and the next day, and not make this hour-and-a-half round trip with the crush hour. The crush hour in Tokyo lasts from 6:30 in the morning to 11 at night. It used just to be the business rush hour. Now it's the crush hour from morning till night. Oh, it's really something. So, I tell you, hauling our suitcases on those trains, my back ached for days. The only mistake I made in getting ready for this trip, Leroy, I didn't take weight training before I left. I've started since I got back. Hang those suitcases on those trains and push through those people. Boy, for little folks, those Japanese are tough. But when Hugh Harris will go downtown, downtown, if there is such a downtown Tokyo, it's the biggest city in the world, they go in the morning and they're pounding that pavement till late at night, up and down these stairs in the subways, and for the first week my legs ached. Oh, just following around. Well, Bordy admitted that when he got back from furlough, it took 2 weeks to get physically conditioned just to walking around. And what they've done, they've located hotel lobbies that are the quietest and have got little nooks so that between appointments they go to the Marunouchi or some other Fairmont hotel lobby, and that's they get a little relaxation, a little quiet time, then go out to their next appointment. So, but the point I'm trying to make is that these guys are after it. We're meeting with folks, and I went with them. Down in Okinawa, the guys are after it. Of course, Okinawa is really that's a plum. You got 40, well, I don't know how many servicemen are there now, since so many of them are down in Vietnam. By the way, I saw in the paper last night that it looks like we're going to up our number in Vietnam to 300,000. We went out to do a little evangelism there, and so I went out with this young ex-Marine who had been discharged that day. His name was Zeke. So we had paired off, so we went down to a snack shop, and we were walking down the sidewalk, and he looked in the window, and there was a guy who looked like he was an Indian or somebody. He was a Marine. He was sitting by himself, and old Zeke says, "There's one!" Have you ever heard of the pie? I says, "The what?" The pie. This is an approach or an illustration they've got. Boy, I thought to myself, this guy attacks non-Christians like he's being ambushed by the Viet Cong. You know? Before I knew what had happened, says, "There's one in the door, in here, too." Bump. "Have you ever heard of pie?" "No, I hadn't heard of the pie." I said, "Let me show you the pie." So he began to draw an illustration here. I think this is one Harvey Soderholm or somebody has worked out in depth. So after this a little bit, about 20 minutes, the fellow finally said, "Look," he said, "I've got a ticket for the theater. The show starts in 4 minutes." And he held up his ticket. He said, "I got to leave." So Zeke wanted to charge somebody else. I said, "Wait a minute, Zeke, have a seat here. Sit down a minute." So I said, why don't you get us each a Coke? Here, I'll pay for it. You get them, I'll pay for them. Okay. So we got a... I said, now let's just sit here a little bit. Let's look at this situation. Guys were coming in and out, jukebox and boxes playing real loud and so on. I said, now let's watch. Let's see how long these guys stay. Let's just look over the situation here. So we looked it over for a while. So I said, Zeke, do you know any guys in any barracks around here? Well, yeah, it's a little walk. I said, how far? He said, 2 blocks. I said, man, I'm not that soft a civilian. Let's go. So I said, now if the guy in charge over there wants to know what I'm doing there, well, you're taking me up to introduce me to your friend. So we went and looked him up, and that led us to another friend and so on. But the thing, the point is, I like the way Zeke does it better than a lot of people don't do it. Now, he was wide open to a little instruction as perhaps how to do it a little more smoothly. But he's at it. That's the point. Denler, Gene Denler. 88% of the people in the Philippines are nominal Catholics, so Gene Denler decided that he ought to set the pace and get out working with Roman Catholics. So he himself, up to that time, had personally contacted and witnessed to 200 Roman Catholics, kept records. I mean, now that's quite a few people. By the way, just an interesting little story. I didn't get over in the Philippines, but Doc Bremner, who was a wonderful traveling companion, and what a blessing he was to me and to everybody, everywhere he went. And also, Dr. Bremner is a general practitioner, limiting his practice primarily to obstetrics and pediatrics. If there's anything the navigators can use around the world, there's somebody who knows something about obstetrics and pediatrics. And everywhere, like, here's a kid with a rash, here was this and that, something else, and so he was a great help that way. I mean, we've got kids all over the place everywhere you go, as far as the navigators are concerned. I think it's wonderful, too. And, except, I just soon see one at a time, please. And, but anyway, Doc told me about Rudy. Rudy, at the time Doc was there, was 3 weeks old in the Lord. Rudy had been a gang leader, a pretty tough gang in Manila. And I'm not too sure how Gene came in contact with him, but Rudy began to spend about an average of 5 hours a day over at Gene's house, just hanging around. And after about a week of this, Gene led him to the Lord. So Rudy kept hanging around every day of the week, 7 days a week, 5 hours a day that Gene would spend with him. And it was wearing Gene Denler out. And so on Saturday, Gene said, well, Rudy, been good to have the time with you today. Well, we'll see you on Monday. Rudy said, have I done something wrong? Have I hurt you in some way? Well, no, Gene says, why? Why do you ask? Well, is there any reason why we can't get together tomorrow? And this guy is soaking it up, and he has to from the background from which he came. Doc told me that he had met Rudy, and Rudy was asking him questions, and he didn't know how young he was in the Lord. He would have assumed him to be a year or two old in the Lord by the questions he was asking. But Rudy's gang was after him, and he was pretty much afraid of him. They came over one night pretty much drunk, and they wanted to get Rudy to go out with them on a binge. And he said, no, I've become a Christian. I'm not going with you. And just to show him, they took his dog, killed it, skinned it, cooked it, and ate it right in front of him. I'll show you. The next day, they sobered up, and they relented a bit, and they brought him another dog. But, I don't know, maybe they're getting ready for the next banquet. I don't know. You know, in the last 5 or 6 months, they've all of a sudden had quite a breakthrough in the Philippines. And they've got some guys there that are 3 months old in the Lord, have led 2, 3, 4, one fella, 8 other fellows to Christ. And they've got so many young Christians running around, they can't keep the new Christians from winning other people to the Lord. They've got a real follow-up problem on their hands. Then talk about our guys after. There was a satay party in Singapore. Now, satay is a Malaysian answer to the American barbecue. And they put little pieces of meat on a little stick and sort of barbecue it. And I'll tell you one thing. Yeah, it's hot. So Jake had this in his home, and it's a big deal out there in Singapore. We must have had about 30 or 40 non-Christians there that night. But the interesting thing to me was that after we were all through, Downing gave his testimony, I gave a gospel message, to see their contacts at work. I mean, there were very few people that escaped. I don't imagine I saw more than three or four people actually get up when the meeting was over and leave. Here was a guy with two or three around him, here was one with one, here was somebody over here with three. I mean to tell you, and I've been told ahead of time, said, don't worry about afterwards, that the fellows will take over. And they did. Yeah, it was really a joy to see. And Joe Simmons. Joe, before he came to the States a few years ago, his main ministry was with businessmen, and a good ministry, too. But he came to the States, got around to some of the areas, and saw the navigators were working with college students, and Joe thought he'd work with college students. Now, Joe will be 50 years of age. And he was here in the States, what, about 3 or 4 years ago? Well, 3 years ago? Well, he went back to New Zealand, and I want to tell you that Joe has got some real sharp young college students coming up. Here's a fellow that's very adaptable. You talk about Zeke. You know, Roy Robertson's a tiger. We were down in Melbourne, and he decided that we ought to do some survey evangelism. Well, I was busy with public relations, which seems to be my lot in life, so they get to have all the fun. So Roy took Joe, Doc Bremner, and David Wilson, who is our contact down there, businessman. And then there's a young guy who was staying in the mission home we were. He's a track man, quite a track star in Australia, Christian fellow. He's later going to come to Calvin College up in Michigan. A fellow who thought it was very important to be orthodox doctrinally, but didn't have this vital thrust. And he was giving all the reasons why you couldn't do evangelism on the campus. First thing, they were Australians, and secondly, it was for the exam week. And so Roy kept saying, well, don't they at least have lunch? Don't they eat? Well, you know, they eat. Well, let's go. And so they went. And, boy, they came back, you know, just hiring kites, and Doc had led somebody to the Lord along the way. So not only in evangelism, but also in discipling, everywhere I went, they're working at it. That was a good thing to see. I didn't find a lazy navigator in a whole bunch. Then the second thing is that we're farther ahead than I thought we were. I told you about Japan. I think here we've got the basis for contact. We need to zero in on prayer for reaping. Singapore, they've got 100-plus young fellas, plus some gals, to be deepened and trained. I went out and spoke in the Polytechnical Institute to an IV group, and some fella introduced me. No, took the meeting, and then Tom Lee got up to introduce me. And the meeting was sort of a piece of wet Kleenex up till that time. But when Tom Lee got up, this Tom Lee had lived in Roy's home for a couple of years, and he got up to introduce me, and he took charge. He absolutely took that whole meeting, and it was just a complete change. I mean, he's a leader, fellow, humble, but he's a leader. He knows the word. And I met his babes, who in turn have blessed young Christians, who in turn led other young Christians to Christ. Oh, I also met Philip Tan. I began to call him Philip Brown, you know, because it's Philip Tan. I said, I can remember Brown better than I can. He thought that was a big joke. And so every time I met him, it was Philip Brown instead of Philip Tan. And this is Jimmy Choo's key man. And I went through my slides that I took, and I started with Philip. I got five generations there that I met and talked to. the day we had a one-day conference there at Robertson's home. Speaking of Robertson's home, boy, that's quite some place. Do you know that for 1 week, they slept and fed 100 people? Now, they slept and fed them Singapore style, but they slept and fed them nevertheless. Literally under the house as well as in the house. That's quite a deal. The day we had the one-day conference, I was talking with some of the young guys during the week ahead of time, and they said, well, you know that we can't invite our third and fourth generations here because we won't have enough room. We've been told that we can only invite the first and second generation. That was rather interesting, wasn't it? When Ron York went to Korea, the Lord gave him the friendship and the ministry and the life of a young man named Paul Yu and his wife Sukja, and a little guy whose name is the little boy whose name escapes me. And they have gone down to Singapore to live with Robertson's for a year. And Roy feels that Paul Yu is far and away the top man that he has around there. Paul had led about 25 people to the Lord while he was in Singapore. He is very sharp. He believes God. His wife is with him 100%. And they're quite a couple. We've got some public relations problems back in Korea as far as this is concerned, but that's another matter. I thought later when I had outlined this that I don't have listed any of the problems. We've got some. But it's a real delight to see. Also a little startling, I mean, in this little Korean boy, I see him running around the place in the all together. Nothing. I mean, stark, naked. And kind of reminded me that, yeah, that's right, I'm in the Orient, I forget. One of the things that the Robertson trying to teach him, though, is to wear trousers. But things are different in some parts of the world than they are in other parts. I remember when I was down in Latin America some years ago, the little kids in Sunday school, the little kids down there running around with shirts and nothing else. And they were coloring some Sunday school material where the little kids had pants on, but no shirts. And these little kids said, well, that's wrong. You know, that's the way you dress. After all. This must have come from these backward Americans. When I was in New Zealand in Christchurch, where Joe Simmons lives, it's named after the church there in town, a big that dominates the landscape. New Zealand's a beautiful, beautiful country. It's all that they say about it. It's also a little behind times in some ways. They've only had television for 2 years, for instance. And as in so many of these places, what do you flip on the TV set and what do you see? Well, I was in Sydney and I flipped it on one afternoon, and so I watched combat. in New Zealand, we went into the dining room, and we had to wait for a little bit, so they put us in the lobby, and what were they watching there of all things? The Munsters. But to me, the funniest thing of all is to see Gunsmoke where they speak Japanese. That is really funny. To see Matt Dillon talking Japanese, it's really a kick. Because it's amazing how they match the lip movements. It's that it's almost perfectly. But down in New Zealand, I went over for a cup of tea one day on the campus there with a young fellow named David Bibby, 19 years of age. You know, I couldn't help remember, but years ago, when I had a cup of coffee with a guy at Northwestern Schools in Minneapolis talking to him about his future, and that young kid was 20 years of age at the time, and it was Waldron Scott. And this young fellow, David Bibby, who wants to serve the Lord overseas, outside of New Zealand, and would like to serve with the Navigators. Just his bearing, his thinking, his depth in the Word for a couple of years of age old in the Lord reminded me a great deal of Waldron Scott. And I would say that we could well have a future staff member from Christchurch, New Zealand, by the name of David Bibby. There's another fellow there by the name of Don Christensen. Don Christensen is part Chinese. He's 26 years of age. He openly admits that his mother was a prostitute. He has no idea who his father was. Don Christensen has had 1 year of formal education in his life. Yet Don Christensen is probably one of the two key men that Joe Simmons has. For instance, Don went down to Dunedin, which is a couple hundred miles south of Christchurch, to a medical school. And there he led a fellow to Christ by the name of Horton. His first name is Haskin. It slips me. Haskin, something different anyway, Horton. One of the sharpest young guys you could meet. Athlete, cricketer, rugby player, sharp in many ways, medical student. And who led him to Christ? Don Christensen. And this fellow, Horton, said that Don Christensen come down to our school and said he'll hold his own with any of those fellows when it comes to talking about Christianity or philosophy relating thereto. And everywhere I went, it seemed like I met somebody who'd either been led to the Lord by Don Christensen or who'd been led to the Lord by someone that Don Christensen led to the Lord. Oh, this fellow's name is Hamish Horton. He's only 6 months old in the Lord. He came up to Christchurch to see us. And Doc Bremner was out, and we had a luncheon of about 60 businessmen one day, and Hamish came. Oh, you know, just a little side like it. I'm taking too long here. But, you know, oh, there are a lot of things. I must have spoken 45 or 50 times in this whole trip until I really go about spoken out. And they set up a luncheon in Christchurch, and about 60 businessmen, mostly businessmen and some pastors. And I think I counted 7 or 8 were asleep afterwards. You see, I wasn't doing too well. And I was also, by this time, I was ruining all of these meetings. Yeah. But over here was a little row of guys who were just sitting there like this. And bright, yeah, making notes. Who were they? Hamish Horton, Don Christensen, David Bibby, Joe's man. Oh, man, what a delight. Well, after this luncheon, Doc Bremner took Hamish Horton, this young medical student, 6 months old in the Lord. They went out to a neighboring park, beautiful day, and sat down to talk. And a little moment, Hamish said, "Excuse me a minute." He said, "That fellow over there looked to me like he's in trouble." There was a man there, a businessman, sitting over another bench. So he says, he went over and sat down and said, "Excuse me," he said, "you know, you look like you're in some kind of difficulty." I don't believe I've seen one that looks as downcast as you have and heavy-hearted. Could I be of some help to you?" And this fellow had come to that, had been the new luncheon. So Hamish began to work and gave him his testimony. An interesting little sidelight that this same fellow on business came up to Auckland, a couple hundred miles north, a week later, and was in our meetings up there, and Doc spent some more time with him. But this is a kind of a breed that's coming along. This is what I mean when I say that we're farther ahead than I thought. And the public relations, too, on every level, I'm amazed. I was really amazed in Singapore at what we're doing in the churches. And I couldn't say this publicly either, but David Bibby told me, he said, in Christchurch, whether it's Youth for Christ or this church, is any real key going persons or navigators. Well, it was nice of him to say it, but the point is that our job is to raise up laborers. And God is helping us to do this. In Jimmy Choo's church, which is an open brethren called Bethesda Katong, last year 75 of the young people led at least one person to Christ last year. Never heard anything like it. I'm not quite finished. Why don't you stand up for a minute and stretch here, and then I'll... I'm amazed, as I got around the area, how many people I met who have been in Glen Eyrie. Of course, some of you recall that we've had various times we've had some Japanese businessmen come, and when I went to speak at an early morning breakfast in Japan, downtown at one of the hotels, there was a prayer breakfast, there were 4 or 5 businessmen there who had been in Glen Eyrie, and unlike Japanese, they'd slap me on the shoulder, at least I'd never had this done before, because they'd been here, had lunch with us. And then they would, and then I would hear them talking about Glen Eyrie in Japanese to somebody else. I hardly had a chance to speak. They were all telling the story of the navigators to guys who didn't know about it. And down in Melbourne, Professor Basil Brown, who had spent 3 days here at the Glen, and he had mentioned publicly once he had 5 minutes with me and 3 days with Warren Myers, and that was a good deal. But you know what I got down there? He set up a tea in an afternoon for Christian leaders of Melbourne at his own expense. Got all the word out and paid for the tea. The next afternoon had a pastor's get-together also that he put on. And he just felt like he was one of us. He'd spent 3 days, wonderful days at Glen Eyrie. And Ray Turkington in Wellington. When we flew up one day from Christchurch to Auckland, Joe arranged it so we had 3 hours in Wellington. Instead of a non-stop flight, we got on this puddle jumper and stopped in Wellington. And to meet us was Ray Turkington, who had been here at the Glen, and about six or seven others that he'd gathered up, and he'd also arranged for the conference room, and so we had a conference, a meeting, a little half-day conference almost, between planes there in Wellington. In fact, Joe thought it was the best conference we had the whole time. Then there's Don Laugesen, who is one of the leading Christian businessmen in New Zealand. He's been here, and he expects to come back to the States in August, and it's very important to him to arrange the timing of his visit to the States with his family so that it's either his daughter or daughters, I forget whether it's one or two, can be here for one of our collegiate conferences in August. And so I've sent a note around to you on that, John. You can be looking for Don Laugesen when he comes. But it's really amazing how out there, how they feel such a close kinship to us because they've been with us here. It was really something. And you know, God has some choice servants around the world. I think one of the choicest servants is Dr. Chu, Jimmy's dad. Jimmy's dad is 56 years old. He studied the Bible for years. Many times nights he studies it till 2, 3 in the morning until he's almost hurt his health. He has his own summary and outline of every book in the Bible. In fact, some people are insisting that he published it. He probably is as close to a Jack Mitchell of knowing the Bible as anybody that Roy Robertson knows in the Orient. He's read all the philosophers from Plato and Aristotle right on down through Mind at the End of Its Tether by however you pronounce his name, Jean Paul Sartre. And he said, Lauren, I read all of these philosophers all the way down, and there's not one philosophy that has ever come up, I've read in any, that is not mentioned in the book of Ecclesiastes. They are all there. But what a warm-hearted man. He got me aside one evening at his home and said, Lord, it's been on my heart just to tell you. He said, you know, in Vietnam, the Americans are building a permanent base. They're going to be there for years and years and years. And he said, I'm praying that you're going to send more workers to the nationals of Vietnam, because I think that field is going to be open for a long, long time. But he's a, what a godly man. We got in this little town of Kuala Lumpur that hardly we ever heard of, Malaysian. As I told somebody, I thought it was going to be thatched roof, you know, grass huts. Here's a beautiful four-lane highways, freeways, beautiful college campuses. Stopped in a first-class hotel. It wouldn't be like the Singapore or a Hilton, Tokyo Hilton, but it was a nice hotel, and the manager, Mr. Locke, is a Christian, found that he was a Gideon, and he had helped get the Gideon Bibles and schools and hotels around Singapore, and he felt that God led him up 200 miles to Kuala Lumpur to take this job as the manager of this hotel as a point from which to distribute the scriptures around Malaysia. And Malaysia has as its official religion, Muslim. That's their official state religion. But here is a man, and for some reasons that wasn't quite clear to me, it was not best for him to bring his family, so he sees his family twice a month. And he lives there, up there in his hotel, and that's his purpose, is to distribute the scriptures around Malaysia. God has his workers. Well, there's Jack and May Griffin in Sydney. Jack Griffin is a he would be he and his wife the country club style, the all day Sunday in the golf course and the drinks and all, and their daughter had come to know the Lord, and for years she just lived a quiet testimony, had her quiet time in her room, and excused herself from the drinking parties and so on, and only on occasion would say, "Mother, would you listen to this verse of scripture or something?" And her mother May told how she'd put her off. And then the church to which he was going, the pastor, began to call on Jack and May Griffin. And, of course, they were the Hale persons well met, and they kind of, you know, they'd take the pastor in. But finally, Billy Graham was coming, and the day before the first meeting, the pastor came by and said, "Look, I've just got two tickets left. I can get you in. Well, why don't you go?" "Oh, well, this tomorrow's the first day. We'll go toward the end. Why go?" He said, "Well, I just got these two tickets. Now's your chance." So they went. And they got separated, Jack and May. And then she sat there and listened. She said how it struck her heart and how God had apparently answered the prayers of this daughter who for years has lived that quiet but gracious testimony in that home. Never preached at them, but lived this and had her quiet time praying. She said, "I didn't know later she was doing this." The daughter's about, 22, I guess, now. And so she said, the invitation was given, and she said, "I had to go forward." So she said, "I got up and I started down." In the meantime, Jack, her husband, it impressed him, and he got up, and neither one knew where the other one was. He went to the end of the aisle, she came down the stairs, and they met. And went down forward and received Christ. The follow-up wasn't extra good. In fact, it wasn't too good. He got made deacon of the church and one thing right away real quick, but nobody following him up until Bob Blockner came along 2 years later. And I'm not too sure how Bob Blockner got a hold of his name, but Bob really poured his life into Jack and May Griffin. And he did a good job. And Jack meets with college students, businessmen, a couple pastors. His business is manufacturing automobile accessories such as hubcaps and so on. He's turned that over to his son, and he puts about 70% of his time on the Lord's business. And they were our hosts, took care of our expenses at the motel, and so on. God has some wonderful people. Then we went to see R.A. Laidlaw, who wrote The Reason Why. This is apparently a highlight for everybody. He's 80 years of age, and he reminds me of Psalm 92:14, they still bring forth fruit in old age. They are full of sap, it says, and greed. This old boy is full of sap. I mean, 80 years of age, bright as a dollar. For instance, after we left him, we walked across, and he started this thing, about a six-story department store, huge place, and we walked across a enclosed catwalk to one of these five or six story garages, you know, parking lots, and it's across. And as we walked across, we could see him walking down the street out of the store, down in his private little garage to his brand new black Jaguar that the employees had given him on his 80th birthday, and saw him back out and zip around the corner. You know, he was in England, or he was in Germany when his family, just at the outbreak of World War II, got over to England, and he got a cable from his executive vice president saying, "If you want to stay and preach the gospel to the GIs, we'll tend to the store." And then he told us the story how of his prayer. Before he got this cable, he was thinking that he ought to stay. And he was going to send his wife and children home. And on Sunday morning, they got the word that the Athenia had been sunk. And they were to leave on Wednesday morning. And he really wrestled with this. And how that he felt that if they were going to be on a ship that was going down, he didn't want to live either. He wanted to be with them. He wanted to go down with them. And so he asked the Lord for some guidance. And he was down on his knees. He said, "And usually the Lord doesn't give me a real quick guidance. He makes me wait." But he said, "I was on my knees and I got this telegram. He said, if you want to stay, we'll tend to the business." So he put his wife and kids on the ship and Do you know that he spent 5.5 years preaching the gospel to those service people in Europe, never saw his family for 5.5 years? And I'm worried about 7.5 weeks. God has some real choice servants around this world. Some real choice servants. Well, I think probably one of the highlights of the trip to me, and I didn't think I was just quite this, probably just a little bit more emotional than I thought I was coming back, but I think I can tell this okay. But I went out to sea in Hong Kong, hunted up Dean Dendler's grave, and stood there and read 1 Corinthians 15 out loud, and I took another picture of it. I don't think Ruth's here this morning, is she? And I got another picture so she can see how it looks now. And when I got through to the end, I just got down on my knees, and on the 58th verse, therefore, my beloved brethren, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as ye know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. So I just got down on my knees there and just sort of rededicated myself to the Lord. And to 1 Corinthians 15 and to the 58th verse. And many a time from that day on through the rest of the trip, I got awfully weary. I thought, oh no, I can't. I speak twice today, twice tomorrow, twice on Sunday. I'm just weary. I just feel like a hunk of meat who's hauled around with a built-in tape recorder. You haul around and stood up and you turned on. And you know, and then you haul around and turned on. But you know what? I come back to this verse and it refreshes me all over. Remember, Sandy, remember. Your labor is not in vain in the Lord. So therefore, abound in it. Abound in it. Okay, so it's only 3 days Melbourne, 3 days Sydney, 3 days Christchurch, 3 hours Wellington, 3 days Auckland, 3 days Honolulu. Abound. 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 Your work is not in vain. Your labor is not in vain in the Lord. That's a great motivating thing. Let me have your Bible here, would you please? I'm supposed to be memorizing this, but it escapes me. I like the way this is put in the... I just conclude with Psalm 13, 5 and 6. But I have trusted in thy mercy. I have trusted in thy mercy. The Lord's been very merciful to me. Many a time I'd just go to bed at night and I'd say, now Lord, today all the blessing, all that I've seen, all the progress, and the ministry, I've trusted in thy mercy. I think that the lowest I got, I could hardly, he began to catch up with me after Singapore, and I got to Auckland Saturday night, the last night before we were going to leave for Honolulu. And I was to preach that night, and I just didn't seem to have it. And I got a little depressed, so I went to see Roy, and had a little chat, and we prayed. And then Doc got some of the, he didn't know about this, but he got some of the people together and prayed. And I went over there, and I just didn't feel like I could hardly make it through another talk. And according to Doc, and according to Roy, is probably the best message that they had heard me bring on the whole trip. And I never had a greater sense of God using his word than I did that night. So I know it wasn't me. I have trusted in thy mercy. In thy mercy. My heart shall rejoice in thy salvation. I will sing unto the Lord because he hath dealt bountifully with me. The third stanza of Channels Only goes like this. Emptied, emptied that thou shouldst fill me, a clean vessel in thine hand, with no powers, but as thou givest graciously with each command. No power of my own, but as he gives it graciously with each command, do this, the power comes. So we're channels only. Blessed Master, but with all thy wondrous power flowing through us, Well, because he uses. Why don't we sing that chorus to conclude, shall we?